Nils. We had In Betweens from their EP, one of their EPs, Gassenhauer, Local Youth. And League of Ten Politicians started. Louis Restelli signing off, but let me encourage you one last time to make that call. That call is that.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is March 18th. My name is Tess Pilkington and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Kanyekahaka, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. First, news. On Thursday, 30 people gathered in solidarity with Raif Sadawi, a Saudi journalist who was released from prison earlier this week. They were calling for his travel ban to be lifted so that he could seek amnesty elsewhere. His wife currently lives in Quebec. And an outpatient group dedicated to helping teens aged 12 to 18 in suicidal crisis is opening in Montreal, called the Specialized Centre for Adolescent Mental Health, or L'Espot Montreal. The centre will prioritise providing services to patients quickly and provide psychosocial and multidimensional therapy. And according to a new poll, 52% of Quebec residents believe the province should decrease its fossil fuel use and focus instead on developing its own oil and natural gas industries. 45% of Quebecers agree with Prime Minister Legault's hope of adopting the coalition Avenir Quebec, which would end Quebec's use of hydrocarbons. And the REM Lest Transit project has been put on hold indefinitely after criticism that it would disrupt communities and take away from public transit. The $10 billion project proposes a driverless train network connecting downtown Montreal with Montreal North and Pointe-aux-Trembles. The project's critics include Chinatown heritage activists, Mayor Plante, and Urban Planners.
Hi, I'm David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Tess Pilkington. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we're sharing the air with Brian Jefferson and Rebecca Titler, a biologist with the Loyola College for Diversity and Sustainability.
Good evening. This is your regular Friday evening host, Brian Jefferson. Tonight, I want to bring your attention to the Celebrating Indigenous Expertise in Sustainability Conference, taking place this Wednesday, March the 23rd to Friday the 25th. The conference is a series of panels, discussions, workshops, and presentations in celebration of Indigenous expertise in sustainability. This online conference brings together some very honored guests, as well as faculty, students, and the broader community from the university and beyond. And that was Rebecca Titler, a biologist with the Loyola College for Diversity and Sustainability. The conference takes place next Wednesday, March the 23rd to Friday the 25th. Don't forget to register for the event as it is free and open to all. Just Google Celebrating Indigenous Expertise in Sustainability. That's Celebrating Indigenous Expertise in Sustainability, and follow the links. Thank you very much. Hi, Rebecca. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and the work that you do at Loyola?
Yeah, sure. My name's Rebecca Titler. I am a biologist by training. I teach at Concordia University at the Loyola College for Diversity and Sustainability, where I also am the academic advisor and coordinator for our students who are minoring in sustainability studies and diversity studies. I am a settler from a second generation immigrant here in Jajage, where I was born. And as a biologist in my training, I had no real training in Indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge, or it was really, you know, straight science. So being involved in the Loyola Sustainability Research Center and the Loyola College for Diversity and Sustainability has really been a great opportunity to broaden my horizons. The Loyola Sustainability Research Center is a research center that's associated with the college that groups together 50 or so faculty members across the university who are working on sustainability, and also we have a graduate student community as well.
So the Loyola College for Sustainability Research Center and the Loyola College for Diversity and Sustainability are collaborating with the Concordia's Fort Space for the Celebrating Indigenous Expertise and Sustainability Conference. Could you tell us a bit about what that is and the background of what this event is?
Yeah, so every year for the college and the research center, we run an annual conference. And the goal of the conference, we've been doing this since 2017. The goal of the conference is really, has always been to bring out everyone across the university who's working in sustainability to come and talk about their work. So it's been kind of an open discussion. We usually have a couple of keynote speakers from outside of Concordia. And in the past few years, we've had a theme for the conference. We've been trying to celebrate Indigenous expertise, to have that as our theme for a few years now. It fell into place this year, which we're super excited about. It is overdue in coming. And this year we have more external experts coming in to speak at Concordia, but it will all be online, so accessible to everybody. So we're very, very excited, and we'll see how it goes.
So I agree that decolonizing our understanding of sustainability is very important for reconciliation. Who are some of the guests that we'll be hearing from this year?
We have an amazing lineup this year. And I can't even, Brian asked me in advance to think of, you know, who I'm most excited about, and I'm super excited about everybody. So we'll be starting on Wednesday morning. We'll be kicking off with Yuka Navano, who's a professor here at Concordia in First Peoples Studies. And he's Wendat, so he'll be speaking. He's a filmmaker. And we were hoping to be able to show some of his films, but it's not going to work in the online format, unfortunately. But he is going to be speaking about the spiritual practices related to fishing in the ancient world of the Wendat Confederacy near Georgian Bay, and the relevance of that to current fisheries practices. And then we'll be hearing from Sarah Hansen, Deborah McGregor, Tiffany Travers, and Jen Gobi from the Indigenous Climate Action Group, which is Canada's only Indigenous-led climate justice organization. And they'll be talking about the research that they've done, that they've been working on over the past couple of years, focusing on decolonizing climate policy in Canada. And then also on Wednesday is our packed day. Also on Wednesday, we have a large group of partners, of Mihewak partners from Iyushi, who are coming, who are working with Dylan Fraser and Monica Moranian here at Concordia. But we have Pamela McLeod and Andrew Kuhn and Adrian Chukamish and a long list of other honored guests who are coming to talk about a project that they're working on. A co-development project that's designed to facilitate sustainable fisheries management in the north. So that'll be super exciting. On Thursday, what I'm most excited about is our keynote address, which we'll be hosting Danica Bailey Littlechild from the Department of Law and Legal Studies at Carleton. Danica is a Mihewak researcher and lawyer of great renown. An incredible impact. She has done an incredible amount of work as the Indigenous representative on many, many UN processes, United Nations processes, involved in as the Indigenous people's representative in the development of the Sustainable Development Goals, for example. She's co-chaired the Indigenous Circle of Experts under the Pathway for Canada Target 1 for the Convention on Biological Diversity, and so many more amazing things. Like the list of her accomplishments is very, very long, and the amazing work that she's done. She works currently particularly on creating ethical space as an approach to building collaboration based on Indigenous systems of knowledge, law, the protocols and practices, particularly as applied to areas of biodiversity conservation and environment. So she may speak about the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals as well. But we're super, super excited to have Professor Littlechild come. And then Friday, we have some local expertise coming. We have our Indigenous Youth Perspectives on Climate Justice panel, which will feature a delegation from Gaznawage, who went to the COP26 meetings in Glasgow this past fall. So I excuse my Ganyanka Haga pronunciation here, I'm still learning, but our honored guests will be Julie Deo Garade, Jalil Garagwe Metage, Sage Goodley Flabel, Ohunza Geda de Montour, Carly Gagne Dagloft, Alicia Ibarra LeMay, and Natasha Blanchett Cohen. And they will be speaking about their experiences and also their work in climate justice. And then our final keynote for the conference will be Andrea Reed from UBC, who's an Indigenous fishery scientist from the Nisga'a Nation. And she'll be talking about the importance of Indigenous-led conservation and stewardship and focusing on the work that she's been doing in community-based research, studying fish and fishing practices of cultural significance to Indigenous nationhood, recognizing that settler colonial approaches have largely led to huge declines in biodiversity, climate change, et cetera, whereas Indigenous practices have largely led to the sustainable management of, or the sustainable stewardship rather, of our natural world. And so we have a lot to learn from Andrea and all of our guests this next week.
What are some of the dates of the events and how can people register?
It's super easy to register. The events, we also do have some asynchronous events which will be recorded and just posted on our website. So if you Google Celebrating Indigenous Expertise in Sustainability, you will find us on the conference page. And there's a registration link right there. The conference is free and open to anyone. It will all be on Zoom. Some of the panels will also be recorded, so you can catch up with them later if you miss them at the time. We do have things scheduled from 10 to 5, mostly on the Wednesday and the Thursday of next. So anyone is welcome. We do ask people to register so that we can keep track of how many people we have coming, really. But it's not a complicated process. So just Google Celebrating Indigenous Expertise in Sustainability and we will come up.
Thank you so much for meeting us with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Brian Jefferson and Rebecca Titler. And before you go, some news you can use. This Saturday, Montreal's branch of the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress is holding a march in solidarity with Ukraine and its citizens. That's at 2 p.m. on the corner of Peel and René Levesque. You can find out more on the Mega Marché Montreal Facebook page. And McGill students will be voting in a referendum calling for the Student Society of McGill University to increase its support for Palestine. It's called the Palestine Solidarity Policy, and you can find out more about it and how to vote on Instagram at McGill4Palestine. Voting ends on March 21st. And on March 25th, Mobilizing for Milton Park is collaborating with three other community organizations to hold a teach-in at the Georges-Étienne Cartier Monument. The event will be an opportunity to learn about ongoing Indigenous struggles and movements, as well as the different ways to act in solidarity with their work. And yesterday marked the start of CKUT's annual funding drive. As a non-profit, CKUT relies on your support to continue producing grassroots, corporate-free, independent media. That's why, if you can, we're asking you to donate and help us continue providing the best content. The funding drive runs from Thursday, March 17th to Sunday, March 27th. Donate at ckut.ca/donate. For the second segment of our show, we're sharing the air with Pam Palmeda's Warrior Life podcast. We'll tune into an episode in which Tanya Cameron of the Nisashewan Anishinaabe Nation speaks about her community organizing to provide urgently needed aid to Bearskin Lake First Nation. Hey-ya, hey-ya.
Welcome back, warriors. Tansei Sego, Ani Buju, Kwenin Deluizi Pam Palmeter, and I'm the host of this show, The Warrior Life. This podcast is a show about living the warrior life, a lifestyle that focuses on decolonizing our minds, bodies, and spirits, while at the same time revitalizing our cultures, traditions, laws, and governing practices. And it's also about asserting, living, and defending our sovereignty all over Turtle Island. And while we are often weighed down with constant attacks on our nations, our cultures, and our identities, we always seem to find the strength to carry on. That is something that our ancestors continue to pass down generation to generation. And even more than that, we have this inner spirit and determination to never give up, even in times of crisis. And one of the things I admire most about our nations is how we stand in defense of one another and come to each other's aid when we need it the most. Over the last few weeks, Bearskin Lake First Nation in Ontario has been in a state of crisis. They are an Oji Cree First Nation located about 400 kilometers north of Sioux Lookout in Ontario, whose community has been severely impacted by the COVID pandemic. With rising numbers of people who are sick and others who have to isolate, even community services are being impacted. Today's guest didn't just sit back and monitor the social media feeds about this worsening condition. She decided to take action. Tanya Cameron is a well-known grassroots activist who has been working with Indigenous land defenders and water protectors and people advocating to end murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls, to help children in foster care, residential school survivors. There isn't an issue that Tanya hasn't been working on in close partnership with politicians, grassroots leaders, elders, everybody on the ground. I have been following her work for a very long time. She is part of Indigenous resistance, resurgence, revitalization, and everything that's good about our nations. And she does all of this community work and advocacy while holding down only two full-time jobs, of course. Welcome to the Warrior Life Podcast, Tanya.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for the invite.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you here. But before we get into it, even before we started, I was like, look at your background. That is such amazing artwork. Who has done all this art?
My kids are pretty artistic. So you'll see the cedar feathers here. Those were made by my son in lieu of a summer job. With the pandemic, he couldn't get a regular job. So he started creating the cedar feathers, and there's more artwork here that he made. And then my daughter paints. So just behind my desk, the colorful one, that's my daughter did that. And there's a glare on it right now, but she did a portrait of her and her brother and sister.
Oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. Oh, I mean, and it's just surrounded by family and art and expression. Well, listen, before we jump right into things, perhaps you would like to introduce yourself in the way that you like to, and maybe talk about where you're from.
Sure. So my community is Nisatchewan and Anishinaabe Nation here in beautiful Treaty 3. And I'm currently living in Kenora. I'm originally from Winnipeg, had left there after I graduated high school, and has been in Northwestern Ontario ever since. Like you said, I have a couple of jobs, and I've been blessed with a wonderful career. About maybe 25, 26 years of working for the Indigenous communities in Northwestern Ontario. So I'm very passionate and ambitious when it comes to helping my people. And it reflects in my career, it reflects in the community activism and organizing that I do.
Oh my gosh, does it ever? And not just in the stuff that people see. You're one of those people that do just as much work behind the scenes, all the stuff that's going on in the background that no one ever sees and maybe never hears about, but where lots of the real action takes place. And so I've followed you and your work for a long time, like during I Don't Know More and all of those things. I mean, you've never given up. And, you know, I really admire the work that you do. I mean, your passion for our people really comes through. You're one of those natural born leaders who do a lot of work, make a lot of, probably a lot of personal sacrifices, you know, to support our communities. And I'm wondering, you know, for people who don't know you, if you could share maybe some of your life journey, like, you know, what you've done along the way, some of the things, whether it's your education or work or different projects you've worked on.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think my community activism and my public speaking really is from my youth. And my parents always encouraged me to use my voice when I needed to speak up. I was one of the youngest presenters 30 years ago at the Winnipeg's Aboriginal Justice Inquiry. And that's where I first met the Honorable Marie Sinclair. I was just like 13 years old and making a presentation at the AJI. My parents always read the news and always watched the news. So we would have an evening at the table with newspapers back in the old days where we read newspapers. And so we'd read things and we'd talk about things. And I believe I was about 16 years old when I saw there was a suicide crisis in the young people population at Pikangigam. And I remember just talking out loud how I wish me and some friends can go up and you know talk with them, play volleyball, do something to sort of be an example or lend an ear to the young people that were struggling up there. And my mom just started asking me questions. Well, how would you do this and how would you do that? And you know, you have to fly up there. And I said, well, I'd fundraise and I'd do this. And so she just listened to a plan that I rattled off. And then that weekend she made phone calls to friends and family in the northern communities, because my dad is from Sachigo Lake, which is not far from Bearskin Lake. And then she said, okay, well, let's do your plan. And that's exactly what I did. She showed me how she raised the money and got the charter. I got equipment. We went up and we did recreation activities. We did bonfires and sharing and singing even. So that really sparked something in me. And I've carried that through all my young adulthood and now my middle agehood. So I really do have a passion for people, our Indigenous people. And I know it sounds corny when I say it, but I really, really do feel it. I never take anything lightly. Like I get asked to do a lot of things, but I go to prayer. I give it a lot of thought and consideration. And sometimes I think, well, it's a really good idea, but it's not my path to walk. It's someone else's. So I would encourage them. I'd give them advice on how I would approach things. But other times I really feel it in my spirit that I got to step up and I got to lend my voice to it. And I pray, like we pray all the time. Like every time we even go out, my husband left for Sulakout this morning to do a supply run for Bearskin Lake. And we prayed, you know, so we're very spiritual people and we feel motivated to help.
Well, and what I've always admired about you is, you know, lots of us feel passionate or hopeful or inspired, but sometimes people stay in the wishful or the hoping side of things. But here, even from a really young age, you were saying, you know, here's this crisis, this suicide crisis, here's what I would like to do, and here's how I would make that happen, as opposed to, I just wish somebody would do something about this. Oh, I hope that happens someday. And I really love the story about how your mom actually encouraged that. It's like, well, what's your plan? And let's put this plan into action, and that you actually do it and you have that kind of impact. And, you know, the other thing I really appreciate about what you just said is when you work in this area, you get asked to do a lot of things. Far more, 1,000 things more than you could ever possibly do. And some of us struggle to try to do it all. And of course we can't, but it's how grounded you seem to be in ceremony to be able to say, okay, here's what I can give my effort to. And these are the things that I can't right now. How important is that kind of balance and really making sure that you know, this particular path or project or issue is the one that you need to work on, and to be okay when something else is not yours to work on.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing, right? So raising a family, like through Idle No More, my kids were just small. And again, they were my biggest helpers. So that time, plus working a regular full-time job, hearing what people have to share, hearing people's concerns, some of the struggles that are happening. And, you know, I try to be thoughtful. I try to be caring in all requests. And if I have to let someone, of course, I feel like I want to do it all, but I also know that having balance in life is very important. A few times I let myself run so ragged that I neglect my health, and then I get sick. And my parents, you know, my late father was always, you got to pace yourself. You got to pace yourself. You know, you got to remember that your energy has to be for your family as well. So, and I'm a little older now, so I get it, you know, so I realize that I have my limits, and I will do the best that I can with what I can. And I think my activism is only made possible by the help of my husband and my kids and my extended family, who've lifted hundreds and hundreds of pounds of potatoes for me, who've carried boxes from here and there, who have shipped, who have shopped. Like, it, I would not be able to do half the things I've done without the help of my family. So we're a helping family. And I worked for Indigenous Sport and Wellness, and we did sport camps in the far fly-in communities. And when I went up there, I thought, okay, I'm not going to go empty-handed. I'll take my supplies and my equipment. But I did a shoe drive, or my summer students did a shoe drive and a clothing drive. And we took them all up to three of the fly-in communities. And someone commented, because I post everything on social media, someone commented and said, you're continuing the work of your father. And it's so good to see, because that's what my dad would do. He used to, my parents would always get requests, because we lived in the city. Can you look for clothing? Can you look for shoes? Can you look for, and then we'd work to send them up. My parents would drive all the way to Pickle Lake, put it on a plane, and send it up north. So there's things that you just don't get up in the far north, especially when people want to have weddings or special events. So my parents would always do what they can to get things up there. So, and I didn't realize I was doing that. And I thought, well, my dad would be proud of me.
Yeah, of course. And what I like about this is really just how you don't have to go to school and take a course to learn. Here's step 1, 2, 3 of, you know, how to do these things. It's literally how you're raised, the values that you're surrounded by, a family who's very clearly giving, and then you do the same thing. And then it just, obviously your kids are going to be in the same way. And then it kind of expands out in circles, and then all of the people and friends and family that help you, and then so on and so forth. And I think that's the best, really the best part about our communities. And one of the things I noticed, now correct me if I'm wrong, one of the interesting things I thought is, you know, the potato story, that you were getting these potatoes. And I'd love to hear more about that. And I also want to hear a little bit about your focus on women's menstrual products, because sometimes it's something, ooh, you know, people don't want to talk about, but these are very important things for women in communities, as you know, remote communities or communities that are in crisis, or people that are living in impoverished conditions that we often don't think about. People will think about food and water, but we don't think about the dignity of women and girls who need those kind of products. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about, you know, how did you, what were you doing with the potatoes? And then what made you focus on the menstrual products for women?
Yeah, sure. So, so just to back it up, I grew up in, like I said, in Winnipeg with my family. We didn't have a lot of money. My dad was basically raised in one of the Indian hospitals, the TB Indian hospital. So he had a lot of scarring, so he couldn't work. My mom had all us kids and worked when she can, where she can. So when I think about it now, I know that my parents did a lot of work to keep food on a table and keep us clothed. when my mom tells me more stories now, and I think, wow, that was poverty. To be in a situation where my parents brought us kids into the room, and this, my dad was really quiet, and he's like, you know what, we're going to pray. We're going to pray because we have no food. We don't have any supper. And I know he was so hurt. And he said, you know, I starved as a child. He said, so I was promised that I would feed my children, and we couldn't. So we all said, we're going to pray. So we started to pray, and the phone rang. But when we're in prayer, we don't bother anything, and it would stop. Then the phone would ring again. And finally, my mom's like, who's so persistent to call? So she got up while the rest of us were praying. And it was a family member on her side of the family, and said that, bring the family over. We have something for you guys. So we all got up and got to the vehicle, and we drove over to Uncle John's house, and he had a deer in the garage. And he's like, you know, he said, my sons went out hunting, and I thought, well, I'm going to go give one to the Beardy family. And I don't know if my parents ever told Uncle John what we were praying for, why we weren't answering the phone. So we struggled financially. I grew up, my whole family, we grew up on secondhand clothes. We got one new school outfit and one new pair of shoes. So I appreciate the struggles of my parents, and I know having limited access to food and even menstrual products with me and my mom and two other sisters in the home, those were real issues that we struggled with growing up. And my dad always made sure that we help, especially when it comes to food, that that we help our neighbors. So I'm the potatoes at the start of the pandemic, you know, in 2020, spring of 2020, there was a whole bunch of panic buying in the grocery stores in Kenora, enough so that people were like surprised at the bare shelves in the grocery stores. And I just thought it's scary. That's scary how sensitive Canada's food network system is. And I thought it was tough here in Kenora, but then I started seeing people in the fly-in communities posting their long lineups, posting that they had to ration items in the grocery stores to try to make sure all the families got something that they need for their home. And I really thought that was just an eye-opener. And on Facebook Marketplace, I saw an ad for a 50-pound bag of potatoes for $15. And I really thought, wow, that's weird, and but it's also a really good deal. And that was like just outside of Winnipeg, so a 2-hour drive. I responded to the ad, and they said they have so much. The lady said, it's my brother's farm. It's with the lockdown, he's got a whole warehouse of potatoes, and he doesn't want to go under, so we're going to try to sell what we can to the public. So me being me, I posted on social media, hey, I'm going to run to this farm on Saturday. Does anyone want a bag of potatoes? It's 50 pounds, $15. I did not know I'd be coming home with 10,000 pounds of potatoes.
Oh, my goodness.
I had to tell people, like, I'm out of room. I was taking my husband's truck, my SUV, a trailer we had. Two other First Nations had contacted me and it's like, where are you getting these potatoes? So they brought their trucks. And yeah, so it was a really, really big thing. So at the end, within 10 months, I think it was 185,000 pounds of potatoes, the equivalent of 6 semi-trucks of potatoes coming into Northwestern Ontario. It started off with here in Kenora, then it went to Fort Frances, Dryden, Red Lake, Sulakout, and over 30 First Nations. So it was just incredible. Yeah. It wasn't. And like, you know, I think only one time we actually had a forklift with us. So my kids, my sister-in-law, my husband were tossing 50-pound bags from the big semi-truck into people's vehicles as they did a roll and no-contact pickup. But it was good. Like, we were really meeting the real needs of the community. And not just Indigenous people. There were a lot of
families who had lost their jobs, people contacting me saying, you know, I'm really embarrassed, but we need help, and would try to tell me their stories. And I'm like, you don't even have to tell me your story. You just tell me you need these potatoes. You're going to get these potatoes. So, wow. And a lot of people were donating, and I was so amazed at the generosity, especially in at the start of the pandemic. It was scary. It was pretty lean in the grocery stores. And I ended up helping three farms in Manitoba who really needed to offload their potatoes. They were struggling. After the second potato run, I was featured in the Globe and Mail, and two other farms called, can you help us? So it was quite the feat.
Well, and so that's the thing, again, another lesson that, you know, I hope people hear from this is, you hear you are trying to help, and you end up, there's these concentric circles of help. So you're helping to identify, you know, this need, grocery stores bare, trying to provide potatoes. Potatoes are healthy, full of vitamins and minerals. You know, this will keep people fed. And you're also ended up helping the farmers, which ends up helping their families, which ends up helping, you know, concentric circles again of people, and they would have money to buy something that they need, and so on and so forth. So it's really, really important that we all come together in a time of crisis, instead of some of the examples of the hoarding that we saw. Like, your story was just so important. And you would never think, it's all centered around potatoes. And I'm sure you never imagined in a million years you'd be having all of these pounds of potatoes.
I would never imagine that people would be calling me the potato lady. yesterday, my daughter and I went into town, and we went to one of the stores to get the work gloves for Bearskin Lake. And the lady was ringing me up. I give her my status card, right, for the tax exemption. And the young lady at the till is like, oh, you're the potato lady. So even the young people have heard that nickname. So I don't think I'll ever live that nickname down.
Well, it's a good story to be known and associated with, that's for sure. One of the things, you know, of all the things that you do, and there's just so many, and I know they change and evolve over time, but you know, I'm quite impressed that you managed to hold down two jobs during a pandemic, which is very difficult on people financially, mental health wise, physical health wise, just all of the uncertainty. And here you are, even with all the added pressure of the pandemic, working in these two very important positions. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about what you do for Shoal Lake 40 and the Elder Care Center, because I want to talk more about Elder Care Centers after, but for sure, these two jobs that you're in.
Oh, yes, for sure. So I work as the training coordinator for Shoal Lake 40. They have a couple of projects that they're getting off the ground. It's been a little slow because of the pandemic and the limitations on training sizes and whatnot, but we're moving forward with the plan that the community has. I recently was asked to take on the role as the chief executive officer for the Wigwas Elder and Senior Care Home here in Kenora. And I was so happy to be asked to be the CEO there. It was 10 years ago while I was working for the Kenora Chiefs Advisory as the long-term care coordinator with 9 First Nations. I was asked by the ED to conduct a study on having an Indigenous long-term care home within the region for our elders. So that project was almost a year in the making. I sat with many, many elders in our 9 First Nations. We either had a formal circle, research questions. Sometimes we just had met informal within a sharing circle to talk about what the needs are and what their vision would look like if we did get the funding for a long-term care home. And so we did the report, and we did a pitch to the provincial government and federal governments for it. And then I went on to go do other work. But the ED, Joe Barnes, stayed on, and he held firm to that idea that we really need long-term care home for First Nations elders. And so they recently, in the fall, just October 2021, the Kenora Chiefs Advisory purchased the Birchwood long-term care home right here in Kenora. And they also confirmed funding to build a new care home building in Wajishkinigam. And so when I got the call offering me the job, and Shoal Lake 40 leadership were good to share my time. And that's where we just jumped right into it. So I've always been just grateful for opportunities that come my way. People see a skill, my skill set, people know what I'm capable of. So they'll reach out to me and ask me to take on work with them. And I love it, you know. And again, I also make, I'm very a very prayerful woman. So before I take on a role, I'll need time to pray. And I sometimes I just feel it right away in my spirit.
Yeah.
What I wanted to. So I got to pace myself not to say yes to everything at the moment it's offered. But
yeah, that's
I really wanted.
It'd be hard to say no to working with elders. I think elders and kids, I mean, that's just a soft spot for me. And so I wanted to follow up on that, especially when I saw that, you know, you were the CEO of this elder care home, because as you know, during the pandemic, all across the country, but especially here in Ontario, it was revealed just how neglectful and harmful long-term care homes were, these privatized long-term care homes all across the province, how many elders, Canadian elders were dying because of the pandemic, because of some of them weren't, you know, clean, they weren't getting enough food, they weren't getting enough attention, they literally had to bring in the military. So, you know, then that got me thinking about Indigenous elders, because sometimes Indigenous elders are in care homes. Sometimes they're in like elder specific housing on reserve. Sometimes they're within our larger families, depending on, you know, what their health condition needs are. But I'm wondering what you think about, you know, the importance of us assuming jurisdiction over care for our elders so that they would never be a part of that kind of system that wreaked so much havoc.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, over at the Wigwas Care Home, we issued a press release saying that there was an outbreak over the holidays. And of course, we follow all the provincial ministry guidelines. But in partnership with the Kenora Chiefs Advisory, we actually went on above and beyond. We recalled the Kenora Chiefs Advisory, we called a lot of their workers to come in and provide that extra care, because COVID wasn't just impacting the residents, it was also impacting our staff. So to go above and beyond and fill the staffing positions to ensure that our elders and our seniors, the needs were being taken care of. And one beautiful thing that I thought is, like, we had a conversation one evening about the cooks. I think we were going to be no cooks because of COVID. And then we're like, well, maybe we could reach out to some of the restaurants if they had to close their kitchens. And I thought, well, let's reach out to our First Nations, because we have a lot of culinary program graduates. We have some cooks in our First Nations. So I called my chief, Lorraine Copaness in Nisatchewan, and she worked it out immediately. She contacted the cooks in our community, and with no hesitation, three cooks said, we're coming in. And you know what, they're probably just getting off shift right now. And, you know, and that's going above and beyond, right? Taking care of our people and utilizing the skills that we have in our First Nations communities. I think it was just overlooked oftentimes, but truly we have PSWs, we have nurses, we have trained cooks in the First Nations communities, and they shouldn't be an oversight. They shouldn't be an afterthought when we're looking at what the needs are in the care home. And to be able to tap those resources from our First Nations and bring them to Kenora, into the care home, I think that was just incredible. And I was just talking to them earlier today. I'm like, I want to do a shout out to you guys. Please send me a photo. The elders are going to be so grateful that you stepped in. And there's requirements, right, when you're working in a long-term care home, and of which staff, what credentials they have. And our people had it. They came in skilled. They came in and took over and provided the meals three times a day for all of. And I'm talking about, they show up at 6 a.m. and they don't leave till 8 p.m. So that's, wow, Commitment right there.
Again, another example of when there's a need, instead of looking outward, there's like so many people in our communities. And, you know, the government has always tried to assume control over situations and decide what the solutions are. But when we're the ones handling it, it's like, wouldn't you want, you know, social workers and elder care workers and cooks and volunteers all from our own communities? I mean, just so much more impactful. So that's a good story. And I'm wondering if you can also, you know, talk a little bit about, for Indigenous peoples, why protecting our elders has this like double layer of importance when you think about them in terms of being knowledge keepers or language keepers.
And that's exactly it. They are our knowledge keepers. I know our priority listing, like I wrote the pandemic plan for New Saskatchewan, my home community, and we identified who our priority homes, like our priority geographic would be, or demographic, pardon me. And of course, that's our elders, because they carry the teachings and are sharing the teachings right now. They hold the language and are sharing the language. It's so important to take care of our most vulnerable, and that's our elders and also our children. They complete a community, and when a community loses an elder, it doesn't matter what family, what political positions you have in your community, everyone stands together to grieve the loss of that elder. And it's a beautiful thing. Like in any community, no matter how large, how small, we know right away we've got to protect our elders. And I've heard that constantly with what's happening in Bearskin Lake. Like that's who we're there to protect. And it's a beautiful thing. I think the love that we have as a nation for our elders, it comes through in our programming, in our policy, in our education, all these things that that shape our people, right, from our childhood. It's the role of the elder.
Yeah, and if you think of all of the generations of, you know, colonial laws and policies that have tried to wipe out our languages, our teachings, our ceremonies, it just makes our elders who hold these knowledges so critically important. And I love how you tie it to the children too, because they're the ones who learn from the elders in our extended families. And so it's really just important for everyone. So, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, I've wanted to talk to you for a long time, but one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because I wanted our listeners and our viewers to hear about Bearskin Lake First Nation, what's going on. Some people are aware of what's going on. I was following it over the holidays, and of course your work, and other people, you know, were sharing social media about things that were happening. But maybe for people who aren't aware, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what is the situation in Bearskin Lake First Nation, and how did you come to be involved in helping to address it?
Yeah, so as of today, the population is about 400 people. 50% of the population are now infected with COVID. And this is leadership. These are the pandemic workers or even the regular band office staff. So essentially a whole group of community workers are in isolation, which meant other able-bodied adults that are tested negative were called up to help the community in any capacity that they can. And so we were home for the holidays, my family and I. Unfortunately, my youngest, when he came home from university in University of Manitoba, he came home, was feeling a little off, and his friend called, who they all got rides back to Kenora and together, and one of them tested positive for COVID, and he was quite sick. So they called all his buddies to say, hey, I tested positive, you need to get tested. So Christmas, my son went for isolation right away in our home, and he tested positive on Christmas Day. And I'm like, okay, we're home, we're not going anywhere, we're going to try to overcome this sickness. And then I turned to social media and I started to see, oh,
Bearskin Lake has 12 positive. And then the next morning it was 34. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's fast. And I could see public posts on the Facebook pages. Everyone has to go get tested if you've been, and it was just past Christmas, so everyone was together and socializing and visiting for the holidays, and it would just skyrocketed from there. And it was December 30th that, and feeling helpless and seeing moms posting that they need firewood and parents saying that they need groceries in their homes, asking who has a humidifier or who has this and that that they could lend. And I just felt so helpless seeing what was happening in that community. And I reached out to Saul Mamakwa, and he's the MPP for Kiwetinohk. And I said, Saul, I want to help. Can you ask the chief if it's okay for me to take a collection for Bearskin Lake? And I'm going to get groceries to the community. And he's like, okay, let me ask. And within 5 minutes, I got the go ahead. And then I text the store manager at Fresh Market Foods in Sulakaut. They helped me tremendously with the potatoes, getting them into the far north communities. And no hesitation there either. They're like, yeah, we'll help. We'll use our COVID subsidy to ship the groceries up to the community. So on New Year's Eve, the morning of New Year's Eve, I made my post. I said, I'm doing collection. If you can help, please help. And I know asking over the holidays for a donation is not the best time. And I thought, well, if I could raise $4,000 or $5,000, then it's worth it. Like, we could be a help with sending that much groceries. By noon, we had reached 5,000. And I thought, wow. I asked my sister-in-law, like, do you think I could get to 10,000? And she's like, you're going to go past 10,000. And then that night we wrapped up with $11,000. And I was just shocked. I was really pleased with the results. And so many other people said, I wish I could do more, or I felt helpless watching this on the news as was unfolding. And so when I did I do my bookkeeping constantly. To date, we've raised $26,109. We've spent and shipped up groceries, air purifiers, and today a log splitter and other items. $22,328 that we've spent on all that. So I have about $3,700 left, and Canadian Tire is sending me $5,000 in gift cards to buy more supplies for the community. For the groceries that I sent up $12,000 worth of groceries. The shipping for that was $5,300 because you got to charter the plane to get all that food up there. And then for the grocery list, I just posted on the community page and I said, can you send me your grocery items? You know, you tell me what you need. And that's how the whole list was created, by asking the people direct. And I also asked the other day, like, if I'm able to shop at Canadian Tire, what do you need? Like, what supplies? So I have supply list right from the workers, the duct tape, the work gloves, extension cords, hampers, dog food, because when they deliver food to the doorstep, the dogs are attacking it. Just everything that they need. And that's what I'm working on. So Canadian Tire confirmed that it's on its way. So once that arrives, and I'll take the balance of funds, whatever money else comes in, we're gonna do a big shop. My brothers and sisters are ready to shop and help me with their trucks. I got another friend, Larry Cavistra Jr., he messaged and said, you need a truck, I'll take your stuff to Sulakaut. So, and donors stepped up to cover the flights, because again, those are thousands of dollars in freight fees. And they stepped up to cover. So I was so appreciative. I sent up that log splitter today, along with a big, big box of menstrual products and the work gloves and warm clothes. So that was covered by a sponsor, and that charter must have been at least $6,000.
And that's the thing, like a lot of Canadians who don't live or travel in the North. I mean, when I was doing work in Northern First Nations, it is three times as expensive to travel to the North than it is to go to Florida or to Hawaii or to go to Vancouver, like literally flying into the North and then just to try to ship anything. The costs are just exorbitant. So it's just so amazing to hear. It's one thing to get the groceries, but to get them there could cost even more than the groceries themselves. So that's incredible. So, I saw your tweet online about, you know, where things are right now. Are you still collecting funds?
Yes, I'm still collecting funds. I think I'll wrap it up early next week. Okay. I'll collect what I can and it'll all go to supplies and I'll do another run to Sulacoat, and that's about a 2.5 hour drive from here in Kenora. We'll get the items up into a plane. Again, a sponsor stepped up and said, this is the information you need to send your supplies. So, you know what, every dollar helps. Some people gave $10, $11. And you know what, all that pulled together has impact. Like, it don't feel bad if you're, you know, not a $100 donation. Like, every dollar helps someone.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And so the contact information that I saw online was this email, tanya@tanyacameron.com, to send donations by an e-transfer or on PayPal. You're also tanyacameron807 on PayPal. So are these still both good links that people can send donations directly?
Yes. Yes. So I've been getting a lot of Americans using PayPal because they don't EMT. So yeah, those are the two, my email and the PayPal link.
Well, then we're going to make sure that we blast out that information too and just keep it going because, you know, as people hear about it, the first question is always, what can I do? And I think that's, you know, that's literally your motto. What can I do about any situation? So I guess, you know, as we're wrapping up here, I wanted to also talk about, you know, advice you might have for Canadians or even other First Nations, you know, people like myself who hear about something in the media and you want to help. What are some of the protocols around, you know, taking action and to helping a community? Because I understand, you know, I've been, you know, we had a little bit of a discussion before this about some of the protocols you took, but I'm wondering if you can share some of those, because I think it's really important that people just don't barge ahead and assume they know what's wanted or needed or how to do it.
Yeah, so we always have to make sure that we don't take a colonized approach when we want to help any community or any family or, you know, whatever the need is. So I always get permission from the group that I want to support. In this case, it was reaching out to the leadership and getting permission, let them know that this is how I do things in terms of like.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode from October 15th, 2022, created by the Warrior Life podcast, hosted by Pam Palmater. If you want to hear the rest of the show, you can head to Pam Palmater on YouTube. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kay Addison, Joel Somerdahl, Tess Pilkington, and Sarah Jesma. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at Off the Hour, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for us on CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next.
Ça va. Super. Pas pire pantoute. Numéro 1. Ça roule. Bien, merci. C'est cool. Comme sur des roulettes. Ben correct. Quand on se fait demander comment ça va, on dit souvent que tout va bien, même si c'est pas toujours le cas. Si ça ne va pas, parlez-en. Pour trouver de l'aide, appelez InfoSocial 811. Parce que parler, c'est commencer à aller mieux. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT's annual funding drive, CKUT Till Infinity, takes place from March 17th to 27th, 2022.
We have brand new merch available for our donors, including shirts, bags, and hats.
Donations over $30 will also be entered to win from a selection of exciting prizes from our sponsors.
This year's sponsors include
Loofah Farms,
Briar Patch Magazine,
Pop Montreal,
Encore Books and Vinyl,
Drawn and Quarterly,
La Bobineuse,
RIDM,
Mutech,
Centaur Theatre,
DNL Cycle,
La Maison des Bières,
Cinéma du Parc, Bobien and Dumisey,
Death of Vinyl,
La Rama Records,
Constellation Records,
Celluloid Lunch Records,
and Pizza Bouquet.